Okay, thank you. And maybe since not everybody was here yesterday, so I'll just, and anyway, just remind you briefly of what we've been doing yesterday. And so the first thing was, first step was to show that there was a unique measure supported on the set of self-avoiding loops in the plane. When I say unique and when I describe measures, I always do it up to multiplicative constants because these are infinite measures, and such that for any simply connected domain D, and for any conformal map phi from D to phi of D tilde, which is conformal, then the measure mu restricted to those loops gamma that are subsets of D, if you take the image under phi of this, then you get mu of phi. Right? So I argued that this measure was unique just out of a very simple, I mean, that there was at least one such measure out of simple considerations. And then the construction, one possible construction, and there were, I mean, two possible constructions were both very non-symmetric constructions in the sense that we were constructing a measure satisfying the same property, which is not supported on self-avoiding loops by, for instance, looking at the Brownian motion measure, loop measure, or by taking a percolation, sort of counting measure of percolation clusters. And then once you have this measure on non-simply connected, on non-simple loops satisfying the same property, then you get a measure on self-avoiding loops satisfying the same property just by taking the outer boundary of the previous one. Okay? So you have this measure on Brownian loops, take the outer boundary of the Brownian loop, and then you get this thing. And by construction, sort of, for instance, via Brownian loops, and by construction, this looked very non-symmetric, in the sense that inside and outside play a very different role. And then, the most of yesterday's lecture was sort of devoted to convince you and to prove the fact that the measure you get there is, in fact, inside-outside symmetric, in the sense that if you take, for instance, any two domains in the upper half plane, and you choose them in such a way that the conformal, I mean, that the annulus that is defined as sort of H, that there is a conformal map phi from H minus A onto H minus A tilde, the upper half plane is H here. So the conformal radius of the annulus is the same in both cases. Then we saw that the measure mu that we get over there, if you're restricted to those loops that stay in, let's say, okay, in H minus A, and if you take the conformal image under this conformal map phi, then you get the measure mu restricted to those that stay in H minus A tilde. And of course, here, this is very different because, of course, the conformal map phi, just for those of you who are not sort of born complex analysts, but probabilists who sort of learned a little bit of it, of course, here the conformal map phi does not extend inside A, right, necessarily. So it's not just a, it's really a, something different than what you get there. So in particular, because of conformal invariance, you get just out of this the fact that if you take any annular regions in the plane, and any other one, then if they have the same conformal radius, you have the conformal map from one to the other, and therefore the measure mu, I mean, that basically the property you have over there at the top is not only true for simply connected region V, but also for doubly connected, I mean for annular type regions. And in particular, the total mass of the set of loops that go around is the same in both cases, right? And therefore, you have so there's a universal function. Well, universal is just you define the function that way, so that F, so that for any annulus of conformal radius, say, let's say that you can map it conformally into the this annulus, so then you get log conformal. Okay, anyway, such that for any such guy here, the mass of the set of loops that go around and stay in this annulus is this function of R. Okay? And so out of this, you immediately see that the measure mu that you construct over there, so consequence the first consequence is the fact that, well, you may first note that this set of events, right, say mu, I mean the loop goes around this, stays inside this annulus and goes around, is also a generating system of the sigma field that you're looking at, right? So if you have a measure on self-avoiding loops, and if you know the mass of the set of loops that go around each conformal annulus, then it describes the whole measure. And since the conformal annulus, I mean, if you take a look at the Z gives 1 over Z transformation in the plane, this will sort of preserve the conformal radii of annulus, and therefore the image measure of mu under inversion is still the same measure as the one you started, because it satisfies the same property here, and therefore it's the same measure. So mu is invariant under Z gives 1 over Z. So in particular, you can construct, let's put it this way, if you restrict yourself to the set of loops that surround 0, okay, you could as well just say start with a Brownian loop soup, with a Brownian measure. And instead of taking the outermost boundary, you take the innermost boundary, right? The one that surrounds zero. That's the way you choose the which, right? And the measure you define is the same. Okay. So if you take this loop, you don't know if the Brownian measure can be inside, can be outside. It's the same. And in fact, the same is true for percolation clusters, right? You have this law on percolation clusters. You have this outermost external perimeter, but because of inversion, sort of, you could view it as, and again, it's very surprising because this sort of construction is very non-symmetric, right? So, but it tells you that there is something more in the measure mu than somehow in the percolation things, because it keeps some intrinsic information on the boundary, and you don't need any sort of additional sort of knowledge about what happens outside of it. Right. Right, but then you don't choose the same boundary. You see the thing? I mean, of course, if you would invert the Brownian motion and still keep the outside boundary, then that's fine. But then if I'm just saying that you take the Brownian loop measure, right? And I'm saying that you take this functional of the Brownian loop measure, or this functional, so the one inside, this defines the same measure. So it's not just out of Brownian motion inversion. Of course, this is reminiscent of many things that we're around with the symmetry and self-avoiding walks describe the outer boundary of. But here you see that you get everything for free, and the loop itself is sort of more invariant somehow than the things with marked boundary points say. Okay. Another consequence, of course, is. And by the way, yesterday I think because what I'm going to say is. This type of argument was used also. For those who don't know the, and since it's not published in Vincent's thesis, there is a little chapter or paragraph on things in non-simply connected domain as well. And for those of you who are interested in this field, they might also go to his webpage and, okay, you have to load the whole thesis, but then you have a couple of pages that you might want to read about. Okay, he focuses more on SLE6, but it's. So here you say on the other sort of related things about things in non-simply connected domains, I'll repeat sort of, you have Makarov, Zahn, who have been working this, Robert and Roland, and did I forget? Yeah, Bauer Bernard also tried to do some things on non-simply connected domains. Okay, so what I want to say now is, of course, because you are looking at just self-avoiding loops, right? This will work also not only in annular-type regions, but in any region, right? So if you have different, so imagine now that you have something with a three hole, right? And that you have a conformal map from this onto, say, this slit plane. Well, if you look at the loop here in this region, a loop will always, you have two kinds of holes. Those are inside the loop and those are outside. Okay. So basically, the thing is that if you know the measure mu restricted to all events of the sort of, you choose, you group the set of holes into two parts, right? And you join them by some fixed prescribed path, and these paths you'll be able to change it, but they are prescribed. And then for basically, if you know the measure restricted to those set of loops that surround this, that don't intersect any of the green guys or any of these guys, and that surround this part and that don't hit surround this part, right? And if you know that for any green path, any green collection of things, then you know the whole measure, right? So now we just take a conformal image of the previous picture here. So now you'll get. Right? You have the annular region, you apply the result for the annular regions. These two things are identical, and then because they are identical for any choice of these green guys, you get that the two measures in the two domains with multiply connected with more holes are the same, right? So it's just the same. Once you have it for annular regions, you have it for okay. Now, what did I want to? Yeah, and then there was, of course, the question raised by, which was, what is this universal function here? Right? What is the mass of the set of loops that go around an annulus? And what I want to do now is to describe to you, not to compute explicitly what this function is, because I don't think there's any nice formula to produce. One has to be careful because you see that. So I'm just making a side remark here. I said that the probability, that the measure mu was defined up to multiplicative constants, and there was one measure that you can define by out of the Brownian loop soup, and that defines you one multiplicative constant if you choose a one given normalization of the Brownian loop soup. And actually, sort of the description in terms of log phi prime can be sort of you get the explicit constant out of, for instance, this computation by Garbon and Trujillo Ferreras about the mean area of a Brownian loop. Now, if you do the construction with percolation picture, you might first think that one has to be careful because one is looking at the outer perimeter of the percolation cluster, right? And if you want the actual multiplicative constant there, it's actually a mess because you have sort of formulas for the expected area, say, in some sense, of some of percolation clusters, but not of the inside of the, when you remove the fjords, of the outside thing. But if you fill in the fjords, then it's not so clear that you get a nice formula. Well, okay. So John has a sort of a paper where he has the results about the area, but when you remove the fjords, but not. And here somehow. Okay. Well, we have to. As Ilya said yesterday, I fully agree. Sort of, if John says it, then. It's true. It's we don't necessarily know how to prove that it's true, but it's certainly true. So.
Would you say that if you calculate this mass for the percolation case or do it for another, then they differ by a multiplicative constant, right?
Right.
The constant doesn't depend on the modulus.
No, right. But the constant itself is a problem. Okay, so here with this present approach, let me just show you, because this is going to be related to the self-avoiding loop conjecture. Basically, I want to see what happens when R goes to zero, right? So basically, what is the mass of the set of loops for a very thin, in a very thin tube? Well, maybe. Okay, I cannot resist because I think that this is not something that is very well sort of spread in even in the SLE community, sort of this following construction of SLE assert, but which is actually the one I said I prefer yesterday, but I'm not going to tell you about in order to prove that this you have this inversion property there, but here I cannot really resist. So. It goes as follows. So first of all, there's another measure which is very nice as the Brownian loop measure, which is the excursion measure. So if you're on a non-simply connected, and if you're not in a domain which has a boundary, say the upper half plane, there's a nice measure which is the excursion measure, which is basically integrates according to area, I mean to length on the boundary. So integrate take Lebesgue measure here, so z is here. Start a Brownian motion from z plus I epsilon, and stop it first time it exits the domain. So probability for a Brownian motion started from z plus I epsilon, at it stopped at the first time it hits the real axis. And of course, if you let epsilon go to zero, then this is going to scale down and you see nothing. So you have to scale up by some factor depending on epsilon in order to see something macroscopic with finite mass. And of course, just out, you have to scale by one over epsilon in order to, so that things, this makes sense. And this is nice, of course, because as in the loop soup picture where you had this one over epsilon squared scaling and we were integrating out by, according to Lebesgue measure in the plane, here you are integrating with respect to Lebesgue measure and R, you have the 1 over epsilon scaling, and therefore this balances nicely. And so the measure you define here, which is a measure, an infinite measure on path going in and out of the domain like this, is conform invariant without any scaling. So this would be called mu. Now, if you I have 2 points here, 0 and delta. And now you're going to take a Poisson point process of such excursions. Right? You're going to let it rain brown in excursions during a certain time. I'm not going to describe you. Okay. So that says that a realization of this infinite, of this Poisson process of this infinite measure is going to give you a countable collection of excursions. And you'll have only sort of a, it will look like that. And infinitely many small ones, actually, just because the mass is infinite on the set of small excursions. Now, I'm sorry? Well, it's this Lebesgue measure on R here. So it's just a... I mean, the fact that this is infinite shouldn't scare you because it's conformally invariant. You could do the same on the disk. And so you have big excursions far away, but you don't see them. Now, if you do the same, except that you restrict yourself to those excursions that have no endpoint in the interval 0, delta. So you let it rain brown in excursions only you just keep those that have no that such that the endpoint here do not fall into this interval here, right? Well, now you take this curve, which is the boundary or the inner boundary of the union of all these excursions. If you think a little bit about it and the way the excursion is defined, as the Brownian motion started somewhere, stopped the first exit time of here, right? You immediately see that this green curve here satisfies the restriction property. That's just for those who know what it means, with respect to perturbation of the boundary here. And therefore, you immediately see that this guy is one of the SLE 8/3 comma rho curves from 0 to delta in the upper half plane. And if you choose the density, I mean, if you let it rain the right time, you'll get exactly an SLE 8/3 root, right? Because the rho will be just a function of the time you let it rain. And therefore, there is a construction of SLE 8/3 just by saying it's the inner boundary of this cloud of Poissonian cloud of loops. And here, of course, you see that you have this invariance with respect to conformal transformation, where you remove things inside, or, I mean, put holes there. It's also rather immediate. Now, why am I sort of saying this? Basically, because this is going to be useful to convince you basically what type of formula you get for the function when you try to compute things here. Well, first of all, what I'm going to say now is not fully rigorous. I'm not going to worry about multiplicative constants and things like that. But basically what you have to do, okay, you want to compute in this annular region the mass of the set of loops that go around according to mu, not to the measure mu, but to the measure mu there. So what you're going to do is what we did yesterday. We're going to explore, sort of cut this by a slit, eta, all the way here, and we're going to integrate out, right, the mass of the set of bubbles, so here for each t here, that go around here, right? So we're going to decompose this according to sort of what's the first hitting time of the lowest point on the imaginary axis. Say. And therefore, basically, you see that, roughly speaking, the mass of, so if this is eta, roughly, you'll get a formula like it will be the integral between 0 and r of dr. So it's not entirely true because you have to use the conformal map that sort of maps this slit annulus back into the annulus, and you get some functions. But basically what you're going to end up is integrating this, and then you'll have the mass of the bubble measure in the annulus of radius e to the minus r, something like that. Right. So now, so in some sense, we have to get some information about the mass of bubbles that surround an annulus if you start from the boundary. And if you look at the excursion description, so remember the set of the bubble measure is the limit when delta goes to zero of delta minus squared times the probability that an SLE from here to there goes around the annulus. Now, this quantity, if you look at what this means in terms of the excursion, so you can construct this SLE here by saying you have the excursions here, okay, and you have this inner guy. So first thing that you need, that you require, of course, for the SLE to go around is that none of the excursion actually that hit actually the smaller circle. Because as soon as you have an excursion that goes hits the smaller circle, then you cannot go around. So, right? So you have to kill all the excursions. You have a certain probability that none of these excursions that fall down out of this Poissonian cloud here hits the smaller circle. And this is something, yes?
Sorry, I have a question about taking this annulus.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so it's this small r here. Yeah, so this is different. So that's why you're sort of integrating out according. So now this is just an easy thing. You're looking for the probability that in some Poissonian procedure, no loop falls into a certain, so you have a class of forbidden guys. The mass of the class of forbidden guys is easily out of scaling properties here over there proportional to 1 over r, right? You're just cutting those that have height larger than r, right? If you look at the image under the exponential map. And therefore, you have 1 over r, so this probability is going to be of order e to the minus some constant over r. Right, the probability that no guy hits here. And then?
You're assuming r is small.
Yeah, when r goes to zero. And this does not depend actually on zero and delta, because if delta goes to zero anyway, it won't change, basically. Now, okay, I'm not sort of giving you the full, but I'm just giving you this sort of spirit of what you see. And then the other contribution is due to the fact that here this should go around, right? So the part here and the part there should not intersect. So you shouldn't have a loop here that does this and a loop here that does that, because otherwise then you're trapped here. And if you think a little bit about it, when r is very small, right, this contribution is going to be basically local, because for very small r, it will never happen that this guy is going to hit this guy, right? So when r is very small, the contribution here, of course you know this contribution is proportional to delta squared, but actually it will be proportional to delta over r squared, because of scaling here. R is here. Okay. So this contribution here will be of order delta over r squared. And you're renormalized by delta minus squared. So you end up here by saying that the mass of the set of bubbles over there is of order constant over r squared e to the minus constant over r. Right? Okay, the constants are different. And of course, if you integrate it out over r, you're happy. You just get the fact that the mass is going to equivalent to some constant times e to the minus some constant over r. So, and here you actually see what type of computation you have to do in order to get the explicit value of f, right? In some sense, you need to compute this. And in order to compute this, well, since this is an SLE problem, you can always, this is just some problem having to do with some diffusion doing something, so you can always translate it analytically in some PDE or but Robert is probably going to maybe discuss this, but if you don't have a, I don't see an explicit easy way to get an explicit formulation out of that. Maybe I'm missing. Okay. No. So it has to do with the density of the process there, but you have the length 2 pi, you have of the circle, you have various things. But of what is this C, of course? Okay, yeah, you. Right, so here, now what is C, of course? Okay. C is, okay, you know what the probability is that an SLE A third goes here. This is for caudal SLE A third. You know that this will decay like something like that when L goes to infinity. And you get, and here, this very thin annulus, the main contribution will come from the sort of the exponential, I mean from the length of the annulus. So the exponent that you get here should be the same than the one you get here if you identify this with 2 pi and r here, right? So this is e to the minus 5/8 over 2 pi squared over r or something. Okay, it's just the way you define. You have different choices of defining how do you define r, and but so this is the constant you get here. Now, this tells you somehow that instead of looking at the conformal radius of the annulus, right, you look at this sort of quantity which is L here, or 1 over r, which is somehow the length of the annulus when it becomes very, so you have a very thin annulus. You have a sort of quantity that measures somehow its conformal length, which is 1 over the conformal radius in some sense. Or, and here you know that the mass of the set of guys that stay in this guy decays exactly exponentially in the length. And if you recall the conjecture about self-avoiding walks, where the idea was you are going to put a mass lambda to the minus n for each self-avoiding loop of length n, well, you're happy because that's sort of the fact that this will decay exactly, I mean, it has to do with the fact that this should be the scaling limit of the other one, and so that the mass somehow. And here you get an interpretation of the sort of the connectivity constant of a lattice, which is different than the usual one in some sense. It is just saying, well, you have a tiling somehow of the set of self-avoiding loops, right, into sort of a different, of this continuous guy, right, in the plane. And you want to tile somehow the set of possible self-avoiding loops and say that assign to each self-avoiding loop one self-avoiding loop on this lattice delta z squared, say. Okay. And somehow you have the ratio between the sort of the number of, in some sense, lambda would be somehow the ratio between the number of the mass of the set of those continuous guy that will fall into, okay, this is very vague, but in this particular tile. Of course, the same then, just saying, but because of the fact that you have this infinite, the continuous measure here, you can really view this lambda as just the mass of a tile if you sort of decompose the set of self-avoiding walks loops into sort of walks on lattices. So you might try, for instance, start with this guy with a continuous measure, right? Take, assign to it then the outermost contour in the delta z square lattice, say, that surrounds this, that sort of gives the envelope of this guy, and try to prove that somehow the mass of the set of one given contour will be close in some sense to the length. Right? And then you start seeing, well, this is not exactly true, because each time you have a corner, then things change a little bit. So, but somehow you already see that, but things, the interaction will be local, right? So you start thinking that, well, this will define not an exact sort of uniform measure on self-avoiding walks, but something where there are some local compensation, but maybe the local compensation cancel out globally and will be uniformly bounded by above and below. So it's not so, things are not so bad as you might think. And so maybe this continuous object here is going to be useful to say something on this. So I'm not giving up on that. Okay. So let me now, I was planning to say much more sort of things, but I prefer to go not too fast here. Now, I want to say, make a few remarks about the consequences of the existence and properties of this measure for percolation and Brownian motion, because it's very strange and leads to some... So by the way, I have an open question here. I don't know exactly what the answer is. If you have, and it's related to, of course, the discrete self-avoiding walk problem, if you know that you have a measure on self-avoiding loops, right? And if you know that the probability to stay in a conformal annulus, you don't have the exact formula. You don't know it's f of L. You don't know it's this explicit function of L. But you know it's a function that you control when L goes to zero. And you know that this function is equivalent to, say, this when L goes to zero, and where this equivalence is uniform with respect to the possible shapes. Right? So you have a measure mu, you don't know what it is, but you know that this is true. That this is true. Well, that the mass of the guys that go around the conformal annulus is satisfy this when the width goes to zero. Is it true that, does this say that is mu the unique measure with this property? Right, so it's much weaker than say the mass doesn't depend on is a function of the conformal rate. It could depend on the actual sort of, but it has to be equivalent to always the same thing when the width goes to zero. And so, because, okay, I don't want to, but there are sort of subtle questions. Now, what does this tell you about Brownian motion and percolation, which you didn't know before? Well, look at the outside of a disk, right? You have the measure on self-avoiding loops which surround the disk. This is conformally equivalent to say you can view this guy as being the outer hull, I mean the outer perimeter, that's how you call it, of a Brownian loop here, right? You can view it, say, a Brownian loop measure here. And then you restrict yourself to those loops that disconnect completely the disk, and you have this outer cluster. Right? But another way to look at it is to say, well, it's the inner boundary of some Brownian loop, and therefore that this guy is the conformal image of the inside of a Brownian loop in the complement of the strip of the slit, by taking the conformal image from the complement of the slit into the complement of the disk. And therefore, now you can invert, again, the Brownian motion here, and saying that I take a Brownian motion here, and I restrict my loop to the set of loops that disconnect completely the slit, I take the conformal image there under this of this outer boundary, right? And the two measures are the same, right? So therefore, what I'm saying is the following. You have a unit disk, right? So you have a Brownian loop measure, which is the usual one in the unit disk. And you restrict yourself to those that disconnect completely this thing, and then you have this measure on the outer boundary, which is the one you expect. Now, what is the image of the Brownian loop measure here when you map it there? Right? What you are seeing, what is basically now the Brownian motion here outside is doing just this, and when it hits this, this point here is identified to this point there. So sometimes sort of you jump back and forth here. Or you can continue here and then you get here, so, right? So basically, it's if you would identify these two points here, so if you in some sense, if you would replace the excursions inside the disk by the Brownian motion, by just tossing a coin to know if you, on which side you're going to make the excursion and jump, right? You'll end up with exactly the same boundary here and there. Okay. So in some sense, the structure of the Brownian, I mean the conformal, you can sort of replace the conformal structure inside the disk, and you, in some sense you don't change the law of the outer boundary. You could do, instead of taking this slit, you could just say, something like that, and then the identification of point here will be just like, so you have a lamination of this sort, and then you have these things that go like this. And so here you have a complete identification if you do things like that. Now you can also put some measures inside by sort of adding things here and there and sort of jumping. You can start playing many games. And so this leads somehow to the question, what is the class of sort of what are you allowed to do inside a disk? Can you do anything and define any rule inside the disk, jumping rule or something, in order to construct this, or are you restricted by this conformal invariance to some specific narrow class of rules? So this has to do, of course, with some welding stories, but I don't want to go more into this. But and the same is true for the percolation picture. And then, and this is a bit subtle, I don't want to go, but basically, into details, you observe the outer perimeter of a cluster, right? Now, you say, well, this thing that I observed here could have been observed just by a percolation cluster, or a usual percolation cluster here inside, or by a percolation in, say, just this annular region here. And here where you identify just all the points that are inside but some deterministic lamination, right? So in some sense, you can replace, and this is not so, this has to do, of course, with the inside-outside symmetry, and it has to, it's not so, you can somehow replace the information about how does the Brownian, the percolation cluster, right? We said, so let me just say, you start with percolation inside, and you take the outer cluster, outer hull, and then you get this. So you have this procedure to construct the outer hull out of the percolation. But here somehow, but we know that the outer, the fact that you see this outer hull just depends, actually, does not depend on the conformal structure inside, because it lives on its own. So you can just change the inside and do percolation with the new conformal structure inside, and get the same thing seen from outside. So you have some invariance sort of this map that from the mass, from the percolation clusters or the Brownian motion assigns the outer boundaries with respect to change of the conformal structure as long as you are inside. Right? And I don't want to spend too much time on that now because I'm not sure this is what you are sort of looking for, but I just want to say now that this type of approach, I'll just make two comments, is I think the best one to get the representation out of the picture, sort of, just very briefly. So here you have this measure mu supported on loops that surround zero. So you restrict yourself to those that surround zero, disconnect zero from infinity. This measure is scale invariant, the measure on loops, mu. It's scale invariant, and therefore you can view it as a scaling integration of scaling times a measure on shapes. Okay. So you have a probability measure on shapes somehow, then to integrate out with respect to scale. Now, let's look at it just in terms of the conformal map that maps the unit disk into the inside of this guy. Right. This will be invariant with respect to change of the conformal structure outside, near infinity. Infinitesimal near infinity, if you change things, you don't change the law of the map inside. Because you're looking at you say, I'm coding this guy by the conformal map that maps the unit disk here into this inside. And therefore, you'll have this thing that if you apply L, N, that's just for those L, okay. But this is not entirely true because here we are a complex picture, so. If you basically apply ln for positive n to this guy, you'll get zero. Now, you can change the conformal structure near zero now. Right? And then this time, the rule will be slightly different because you have this sort of, you have scaled out you can get larger or smaller slightly with respect to this perturbation, but still the shape will be sort of the law of the shape will be invariant because of what I just said, right? And then you get this highest weight representation and so on. Except that here the group is too large because you are playing with everything is complex. You are allowed, so you might want to say, well, let's try to do similar things, but condition the whole story to be symmetric with respect to the real axis, right? And if you think about what it means to condition everything to be symmetric with the real axis, you're looking at excursions from positive real axis to negative real axis, and you're looking at chordal SLE, and then you get the 5/8 exponent, I mean the actual LNs corresponding to the... Okay, but this is not... I don't want to say more about this aspect, but I really think that sort of this description here is the one that sort of makes life sort of things more transparent than just focusing on chordal and boundary. Okay, it's more or less equivalent, but this is sort of makes things easier. Now, okay, Scott hasn't arrived yet, and we sort of, I promised him that I would... Yes.
If I do the process on the split, I have a different way of jumping around between boundary points when I have the same behavior on the exterior.
Yes.
And you're saying there's two different processes you give lines to the same exterior.
Yes.
And you sort of ask, what kinds of jumping?
Right. So.
Yeah,
because that's sort of a question. Sort of, it's pretty clear that the white class there. It's also true that it seems that sort of, if you just take, because of what I said here, a Poissonian cloud of excursions outside will do the job also. So that basically, if you take the uniform measure as jumping thing would do also. So you might say, well, you can do many things, right? So. I don't know the answer definitely, sort of, if you can do anything or not anything. Yesterday I thought you could do anything, and then Vincent told me, well, you have to be careful about if you have holes and if you have a different Riemann surface here. So if you have a different structure here, so that identifies, say, this and this and this and this, sort of with like a torus inside here, then I don't know how to prove that you get the same hull outside. So, yes? Yeah, because, I mean, the picture on the right, there's no jumping rule because it's everything is deterministic, right? So the point here corresponds to the point there. You don't have any excursion inside because you have the slit, right? You're looking at this jumping rule inside. So it's clear it's not the same, right? Yes, that's right. But then, of course, you have the whole conformal group that you can play with. So what does sort of... does this generate everything? Okay, but I don't think it's an essential question, but it's just to mention. Okay, so I promised to Scott to say some. So one motivation to do all this measure on self-avoiding loops, right, is somehow to prepare to clean up thing in order before starting to do the actual real business. Which is to use this measure in order to construct some other guys which are more, which are the non-zero central charge objects. So, by the way, sort of this loop measure somehow is conformally invariant, and therefore it shouldn't surprise you that it is a way to describe any conformally invariant quantity that you might express in, right? I mean, for instance, if you look at the two points, right, and in the main, what is the mass of guys that surround the two points? Of course, it will be a deterministic function of the Green's function of between the two points. And if you have different holes, and if you have different conformal invariant functions that describe sort of the relative sort of size of the holes and the modulus and so on, then everything sort of every functional will be depending of a given configuration will depend on the modulus or something of the configuration, right? And same is true when you try to do with the Riemann surfaces and start trying to express certain quantities there. Now, I'm sorry, I don't have much time, but now the rest of the story that some of you have heard a little bit about is sort of trying to make contact with using these guys and what Scott is going to explain to you tomorrow, after tomorrow and Saturday, which has to do with level lines of the Gaussian free fields. And the way to make contact is now not to look for a measure on one curve, but now you have a domain D. And again, you have families of loops, but these families of loops are sort of, you should see them as interfaces, simple interfaces. So once you see it, the inside and the outside become independent, and what you see inside and outside become, so if you think about scaling limit of ON models, which is not what I'm going to, I don't have time to describe to you what the ON model is, then you would expect, say, if you take the outermost loops in the ON model, and the same is true actually in non-simply connected domain as well, you would expect that they satisfy the following property, which is if you take a smaller domain, sorry, you have a random configuration of loops like this in the larger domain D. You cut out something out of the larger domain, so you have a new domain D tilde. And now you have this random smaller domain, which is this one. Associated to D tilde, you have a random domain D hat, which is D tilde, where you remove all the interior of loops that actually do not intersect the boundary. And now you say, well, conditionally on D hat, the conditional picture that you see in D hat has to be conformally equivalent to the one you started with. Right. So this is some type of conformal Markov property in space of the configuration of loops, which is reminiscent in some sense of old ideas of Nelson or about sort of trying to express sort of geometrically sort of some Markov property of this set of loops that you have here. Now, the previous picture gives us, the previous measure gives us a way to construct such measures on configuration of loops, and this goes as follows. The way is take D, and now you let it rain. So you have a Poisson realization of constant times the measure mu I defined before. Right? So you let it rain the previous loops. So they overlap. And the conformal property of the previous one tells you that if you take now the outer boundary of the clusters of loops, and this is something you can do if this constant C is not too large. Then these brown guys would satisfy this property. It's what we call with Scott the conformal loop ensemble property. Now, point is now that when you construct these, the theorem is, and maybe Scott, I think Scott wants to do a little bit the same as what I did in the sense of describe in more detail some aspects of the stuff that is before this story. So he will describe, I think, the proof of level lines of the Gaussian free field are actually deterministic functions of the Gaussian free field in more detail before sort of going into details of what I'm saying here. But somehow you want to say that this way to construct these CLEs that satisfy this property is the unique way to do it. There are no other, not the unique way to do it, but this describes all possible CLEs, right? All possible. And now you see that this measure on loops, that is sort of the counting measure on loops that you get here, which is not the same, is also going to be an infinite measure on loops. So you have this configuration with like for percolation, configuration with many loops, right? And then you associate it to sort of expected value number, sort of this counting measure on single loops. And that here, this counting measure on simple loops that you get here almost satisfies the conformal restriction that I described to you at the beginning, except that, okay, for physicists, it's trivial, of course, because it has to do with the fact that the partition function is not constant, except that basically here the law will be sort of, there will be a function, multiplicative function in front of the sort of scale invariance property, that has to do with somehow basically, what's the partition function of the model outside and inside, which is sort of these two interaction with boundary terms. Right? And just this interaction with boundary terms will make it possible that you change completely you start here, you have this measure on self-avoiding loops, and so you are integrating, you are on the class of sort of loops of dimension 4/3 and things like that, because it's an SLE a third loop. And here, as soon as you change slightly the rule of the game by what sort of perturbation, what's the dependence between perturbation of boundary and the loop there, you completely change sort of the structure of the loops you're playing with. And in terms of central charge and so on, the sort of this intensity C is going to be the central charge of the model, and which is not surprising because of this Poissonian description. If you perturb the boundary here, the interaction between this and there will be due just only to the set of loops that possible that do this, right? And this has to do with the Schwarzschild derivative of. Okay, so I don't want to say too much now because it's I'm out of time, and that's just, I cannot complain. That's what's just my choice to describe you more the self-avoiding loop picture before, but. Yes, so what I want to say now, which is somehow important, is that the symmetry that you get out here of this picture, here you see that this Poissonian construction of these cluster of loops is very non-symmetric. Right? So again, it's the same story as the one we had before. We construct, there's some constructive way to get these, in a rather easy way, these outermost loops, right? But then again, you'll have symmetry showing up, which is not surprising if you think of the O(n) model scaling limit, right? So that this guy, in some sense, lives on his own. Well, it doesn't live exactly on its own because you have interaction with far away stuff, but it's there on its, you will want to construct it then again by putting new loops inside. I'm sorry for those who are not, by repeating the procedure by putting nested sets of loops like this that you're going to end up in. And somehow, the nested picture that you have here is the one that shows up in the Gaussian free field description. So in some sense, the Gaussian free field description is much more, is more symmetric. I'm not saying it's better because I want to defend my sort of my beef somehow in this story, but you have this non-symmetric construction that ends up being symmetric, like for the Brownian loop and taking the outermost boundary. And here you have the symmetric object sort of by involving the Gaussian free field jump lines, which has this nested picture and this inside-outside separation sort of, which is built in, and you can identify the two by in this way, right? And so, for instance, okay, I don't want to say more, but the nice thing about the self-avoiding loops is that I hope somehow that they define, of course, a plus one, minus one. If you orient these loops sort of randomly, right? They define a jump. Let's put it this way. Probably, I mean, I haven't given up hope. The fact that if you take this the Brownian loop picture, that somehow the height given by the sort of total gyration of the Poissonian cloud of loops has to have something to do with the Gaussian free field directly. And I'm running out of time, but okay, I hope I've given you sort of some feeling about sort of in some sense how easy it is, right, to construct these nice measures. And sort of how natural somehow this is, and how surprising somehow this symmetry is in some sense. And so far we don't have any sort of any proof, except there's the SLE2 case, which is one of this curve which is symmetric. The SLE4 guy also, but somehow the fact that you end up by sort of this that there's a discrete model which has this sort of self-avoiding which inside-out symmetry and so on is it would be nice sort of to have some additional grounds sort of to believe. But still, somehow, okay, this you don't need any convergence or discrete self-avoiding walk in order to prove that the outside of a Brownian loop is symmetric. And you have this nice symmetric measure. And so I think I really want to conclude with the fact that there one can be optimistic, right, to prove some sort, probably weaker than, not exactly the one you're looking for, but existence of scaling limit of some sort of discrete measure on self-avoiding loops, just by discretizing the continuous guy. Okay, thank you.